Today's briefing will be presented by Louise Diana on the topic, Chronic Inflammation, Conquering the Chaos Within. Louise did research in biophysics, wrote tests and curriculum materials in science and math for 10 years, taught undergraduate classes at Louisiana State University and the University of Kentucky in biology, physiology, and health, ran clinical trials on new drugs being tested for use in neurosurgery and cardiology, and has lived here for 16 years and attends our church. Louise?
Right behind you. First of all, I would like to say a thank you to a member of your church who is a real asset to the church. I think calling her a gem is an understatement. She can do everything, and one of the things she can do are my slides. And she's done that for us, and she's running the slides today. So I would like to say thank you to her. You all have...
What's her name?
Cheryl Ziskin! Well, don't clap until we see if she does it right. Okay, you all have a handout. When I was teaching college courses, I found sometimes it was really handy to write my own lecture notes. And the reason is the students were so busy writing, they could never really listen and think about what I had to say. So I hit up on this idea, I'll write my own notes, pass them out, and then tell the students, you just sit here and listen and pay attention, and I'll do the writing for you. And that worked out very well. So that's what I've done for you today. I want to make sure you know that I'm not trying to give you medical advice. And if you have an inflammation problem and you're seeing a doctor, anything I say is not designed for you to quit going to your doctor and try what I do, although what I suggest. However, virtually everything, everything that I'm suggesting is a healthy thing to do anyway. So there, if you go to your doctor and say, well, I'd like to do this and this, I'm guessing they would say, very good. The other thing is inflammation has to do with the immune system, which are the white cells, and it's a very complicated system. There are a lot of different types of white cells, and every type has different subtypes, and they have all kinds of interactions. I only have an hour to talk to you. And so what I've done is just try to cut it down to the very basics. But please remember when you hear what I'm saying that everything is really a little more complex than that. And sometimes I'll make a point of that. I have organized my talk for an intelligent person who does not have a science background. And so that's sort of where I'm coming in. About 7.5 years ago, I found I had breast cancer. And it was a small spot, but it was the triple negative type, which is a fast-growing, aggressive form of cancer. And so the doctor recommended that I have a mastectomy and chemo. And I said, okay. So I was ready to spend all summer having chemo infusions. And I got about halfway through the series, and I started breaking out in a rash. And the next time the rash was worse, we changed to a different chemical. It got even worse. And then the doctor and I decided my body could not take another dose of that chemo. So we quit before the series was over. And she gave me some progesterone, thinking that that would clear the rash. It did nothing. And to make a long story short, over the next year, I went to 2 dermatologists, 2 internists, I went to an allergist, and most of them just didn't have anything that I would be willing to do. I mean, there are some treatments that raise your risk of cancer, but I'd just been treated for cancer. I wasn't about to do that. So after a year, my rash had not gotten any better. And I was sort of at the end of my rope, and I said, well, I'm a scientist. You know, I was a scientist. I can read science. I can understand scientific articles. I can understand medical textbooks. So I'm going to see if I can figure out the solution to this problem on my own. And so I started reading everything I could on the subject of inflammation. And, you know, it wasn't just the rash, bad as it was. But I thought, if that's what's happened to my skin, what in the world has happened to my intestine, to my pancreas, to my liver, to my lungs, all inside my body? And to me, it was sort of a question of, you better find an answer if there is one. So I went for about a year doing a lot of reading. It wasn't making a lot of progress. Until I found an ad for a book in the Prevention magazine. And it was a book called Win the War Within. And I immediately, when I read a review of the book, knew, even though it wasn't about my rash, that there would probably be something in it that would be helpful. And it was written by a professor at Yale who subsequently went to Wake Forest and took over the molecular biology department. So I figured, well, if it comes from that kind of a source, it might have something for me. And sure enough, he had some suggestions for reducing inflammation in your body. And I thought, everything I've tried so far has not worked, so I didn't really have a lot of hopes. And yet, when I tried what he suggested, in a couple of weeks, my rash started going away. And so you can imagine how relieved and excited I was about that. So that I went right back and I really got into doing more reading, see what else I could find. Bottom line is, with the suggestions that he made, following them for at least, it took several weeks for it to kick in, I was able to reduce my rash by about 70 to 80%. And I just thought this was fabulous. But I still had the other 20 to 30% to go. Now, as I was getting better, I asked my husband if he would take a picture of what my rash looked like to sort of have a basis. And I have a picture to show you. It's not when I was at my worst. This is when I was about 40% clear. And the rash was from my neck on down, everywhere except the palms of my hands and the soles of my feet. And so there is a picture here. Shells? There. So this is after I had quite a bit of clearing. So you can imagine what I was dealing with otherwise. Okay, the next slide. Okay, our white cells, our immune system, which is composed of our white cells, work for us every day. They have to kill organisms that come in. If we get bacteria, we get yeast, we get mold, we get viruses, we get dirt that come into our body, it has to be cleaned out, and the white cells do that. If it's a live organism, they'll kill it. And also we have cells in our body that are dying off. They have to be carried out and sort of cleaned up. And that's what the white cells do. It's important to realize, though, that when the white cells do this work, it's also important that when they finish, they don't get overexcited. So for instance, you know, if you're just killing a virus or two or a cancer cell in your body, that's one thing. But if you cut your finger, the white cell system goes into high gear, but then it has to shut off as well. So that's an important part of the white cell system. Next slide. Here are some autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune is usually defined as when you have a lot of inflammation in your body for a long time, and it actually appears to be attacking your own tissues. There are about 200 known autoimmune diseases, and these are the ones that you may have heard of. Hashimoto's and Graves' disease are inflammation in the thyroid gland. Sjögren's syndrome is one where the glands of your salivary glands are attacked and your mouth is dry all the time. Or your lacrimal glands that make the tears for your eyes, they get attacked, and that's what that is. Okay, next. Interestingly, there are many, many other chronic problems that have inflammation as a major factor, even though they're not what we would call autoimmune diseases. And Alzheimer's, if they've done studies with Alzheimer's patients and find they have a higher level of inflammation than the regular population. Osteoarthritis, heart attacks is sort of interesting, because we've always been taught, or at least for a long time, that if you have a high cholesterol, you have a higher risk for a heart attack. If you have high blood pressure, that promotes the development of a heart attack. If you smoke, you might have more chance of a heart attack. But there are about 40% of people who have a heart attack who are not smokers, do not have high blood pressure, and do not have a high cholesterol. And for most of these people, they're living with chronic inflammation. Okay, next. Then the question is, you may be asking yourself, well, how do I know if I have any inflammation in my body? You know, I don't have any of these diseases, but how do I know? And it turns out there's a blood test that can give you a general number for the amount of inflammation in your body. It's called a CRP. And if you go to your doctor and they're going to run a blood test anyway, you can ask your doctor, would you mind adding CRP to this request? And they'll do it. And that will give you an idea of how much inflammation you have in your body. If the number is less than one, that's very good. And the higher the number gets, the worse it is. To where if you're over three, the report that you get back will say, you are at a very high risk for a heart attack. And my number when I was about half cleared was 7.2. So last time I had it checked, I had gotten it down to 2.6, and I'm aiming for the 1. However, I don't know if I can get down to 1. You know, I may have had some damage to my immune system that is a permanent damage. I don't know. But anyway, I feel really good about that. Okay, next slide. Here are some pictures of some white cells. They have all kinds of different shapes. A lot of them look more like spheres, and they usually have rough edges around them. They have ultra-small antennae on their surface, not shown. These are on the surface of every white cell and on the surface of every cell in your body. There are proteins that stick out, just one molecule of protein with a molecule of sugar on it, that are on the outside, and they sort of act like antennas. So when a white cell is floating around, and by the way, these are usually called white blood cells, they're in every tissue of your body. And as a matter of fact, 70% of your white blood cells are in your digestive system. And so it's sort of a misnomer to call them that, but they are in the blood. So what happens is when a white cell is going down, is circulating around, and it runs into another cell, it can tell because all your cells have this distinctive pattern. And it recognizes its own pattern, and it knows it's part of you. So a white cell, for instance, is not going to kill off one of your red cells. But you put somebody else's red cell in your blood, you might have a real problem because it doesn't match, and the cell knows this. And so when a white cell sees an invader and it doesn't come up, it comes out as a foreign material, then the white cells are programmed to do something about it. Okay, next. Okay, the question is, or the next thing I want to discuss is, how do white cells do their work? Well, there are three basic ways white cells work. The first one is, these are what we call the killer cells. Their job is to find something like bacteria or whatever and kill it. And here's the way they do it. Here's a white cell. It has these long antennae on the outside, and it hits a bacterium, say. Now, when it does, it binds to this bacterium, the membrane around this area expands, and it sort of sucks the bacterium in. And then as it gets all the way in, the bacterium or whatever the foreign matter is now enclosed in membrane. Like sort of thinking about it like a coffin. Now, these white cells have spheres or vesicles of acid. And so when this gets in and it hits one of those spheres, then the sphere will empty its acid into that area where the bacterium is and kill it. So that's the way they work. And one white cell can kill a lot of bacteria before it gets sort of full and dies off and other ones come to take its place. So that's one way that white cells work. The next one is, no, back shells. The next one is they recognize the invader and make antibodies. And this is a type of cell, they're called B cells, doesn't matter. It is born with one antibody on its surface. And because your body doesn't know what it's going to come up against, it makes tens of thousands of different antibodies. And if this cell has an antibody and it never hits anything that matches, then the cell will just die. And so it may live a week or two, die out. But if the cell happens to hit an antibody, a foreign material, like a virus or bacterium, that does match it, then it gets stimulated and it becomes an antibody factory. So it starts putting out thousands and thousands of antibodies, which then circulate around in the bloodstream and get in your tissues. And these antibodies then, if more of this material comes in, the antibodies are there now. You're ready to kill it off. And so here is an antibody. Because there are two arms to the antibody, it can hook on to two different bacteria or two different invaders. So it'll hook on to two, and then maybe another one will come, and it'll hook on to this one and another one. And another antibody will come, and it'll connect this one with this one. And next thing you know, you got a big clump of whatever the foreign material is, all hooked together with these antibodies. And now the material can't do anything. It can't multiply. You know, it just sort of stuck there in a clump. And then your killer cells come by, clean it up. Nice system, isn't it? Okay, next slide. Okay, this is the third way, and this is really, really important for chronic inflammation. And that is there are a group of cells that are chemical factories. And so they have a machine inside that makes chemicals, and the chemicals then get excreted or secreted into the body. And there are three basic types of chemicals. Actually, there are more than that, but three basic types. One, some of them, these chemicals, will hit another white cell and stimulate it to get going. So it's sort of like the general in an army doesn't do the work himself. He just stimulates other people to get the job done. And so that's one thing that happens. Secondly, it might be a cell that got stimulated by the first set, and now it puts out a chemical, and this chemical will cause a change in the body tissues. It'll stimulate your skin cells. It'll stimulate whatever. It stimulates the tissues of the body. And then there are another set of these cells that shut the system back down. And so those all have to be working in nice order and so forth. Okay, now next slide. In order to understand the immune system, you can think of a hill of ants. And every ant has its job. They're going around, they're keeping the tunnel clean, they're doing whatever jobs ants do. And if a piece of dirt falls in the tunnel, one of them will just carry it out. Or a dead gnat falls in there, they just clean it up. That's no problem. But suppose I were to stick my finger in this ant hole. Now, you know, if you've ever done that either on purpose or not on purpose, it takes about 5 seconds before the ants come running out. And if they're fire ants, you better get your finger out pretty fast or you'll be bit. Okay, this would be an example of acute inflammation. In other words, it's not just one cell doing its job and another one. All of a sudden, they all get into high gear. They're working together to solve their problem. If I pull my finger back out, then they'll wander around for a little while, make sure the coast is clear, and then they'll go back and they'll fix the damage that I did. And so this would be like you cut your finger. All of a sudden, your immune system gets all up, you know, all excited, and you have swelling. You have, you know, all of the, you have heat. You have some pain and so forth, and then it shuts down when the problem gets solved. But now we'll take our ant case and say, what would happen if an hour later I go back and I poke that anthill again? Well, probably the same thing would happen. They get all excited, wander around, don't see anything, then they try to repair the damage. But suppose I go back another hour and I hit it again. And all day long, every hour or so, I poke that anthill. Well, probably they'll build another tunnel. But suppose in your body, you can't go somewhere else. You're stuck where you are. So what will happen is if I keep stimulating, if I keep hitting that anthill, after a while, it's not going to do that good of a job of repairing the damage because they get tired, they get, whatever. And what will happen is if I do this, if I poke it, say, once an hour for a week, probably the anthill, if they can't move, they'll probably die. And that would be an example of chronic inflammation, although most people don't die of chronic inflammation, but it does cause a lot of serious problems. So that would be an example. And like our white cells, they have antenna. And when one passes the other, they touch their antenna, make sure it's part of their group. And so it has a lot of similarities to our system. Okay, next. Okay, there are a lot of different complicated ways in which all these cells are interacting. But one of the major pathways for chronic inflammation is this. You have some kind of a stimulus that causes the system to get going. I'm going to talk about that later, but right now I want to talk about this part of the system. So you have one set of cells get stimulated, and they're putting out chemicals. There are these chemical factories, and I call them C chemicals because if you have any medical background, these are cytokines. You don't need to know the word, but that's why I use the letter C. And cytokines, their job is to stimulate some of the other cells. And while I have one cell pictured here making three rows, there are actually 26 different types of these cells, and they each put out their own. But the idea is the same. Then this cell now has gotten stimulated by the chemicals put out by the first white cell, and now it puts out its chemicals. And I call them E because they're eicosanoids. Again, the word means nothing. You don't worry about it. I just call them E. Okay, and these chemicals are the ones that cause the actual inflammation. They cause the swelling, the pain, the skin rash, the tissue damage. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, why would the body set up a system that does all this damage to us? Well, look at swelling. If you cut your finger, you know, if it's a serious cut, it'll swell up. Well, swelling up brings more blood to the finger, to the sore place, which is good because you need all the help you can get. Secondly, by swelling up the tissue, it sort of locks any germs in that area. They can't get into the body. So that by itself would be a good thing under the right conditions. How about pain? Is there any reason, any value of having pain? Well, put your hand on a finger on a hot stove. There's a value to the pain, because you, and if you fall and you sprain your ankle, you get pain in that ankle and some swelling. That lets you know, don't walk on this foot for a while. So there is an advantage to that. Skin rash, if you cut yourself, after the white cells have cleaned, you know, killed off the germs and cleaned out the debris and so forth, the skin cells have to multiply faster in order to bridge the gap that you did with the cut. So the skin cells on either side of a cut go into high gear and start multiplying. But, and that's great if you cut your finger. But if you're not cutting your finger and these cells get stimulated and they stimulate the skin to multiply faster and faster inappropriately, then you end up with some kind of a skin rash. And tissue damage, so I've talked a little bit. Okay, next. Okay, now we have a problem that if you have chronic inflammation, you have too much of these chemicals coming out because it's causing an inflamed state in your body all the time. So then the job is to find out how you can slow down this process so you're not going to get, if you have arthritis, you're not going to get swelling and pain and so forth. So one way is to go back to that first set of cells, and if you could interfere somehow with the production of these C chemicals, then there wouldn't be as many to stimulate these cells, and then you wouldn't have as much inflammation. And I'm sure you've heard on television advertisements for Enbrel and Humira and Remicade. Those are called the biologics. They work by cutting down the activity of some of these C cells or some of these cells that make C chemicals. Now, a problem with that is, say you have an inflammation like rheumatoid arthritis, and the doctor says, well, I can give you some Enbrel for this arthritis, like Phil Mickelson was given. Number one, it costs $20,000 a year for this chemical. Number two, it only works as long as you keep taking it because you haven't solved the original problem. You're just shutting down these cells. And it has some side effects to it. So even though it works, it's in my mind, it's not the ideal way if you have some other alternative. Okay, next. Next slide. Jump back one. Okay, now we have the cells that are making the E's. Okay, if there are, again, about 20 different types, and they're all making their own chemicals, but they fall into sort of two basic groups. You may have heard the word prostaglandins and leukotrienes. This is where they come in. Okay, if you wanted to slow the production of this line, you could take aspirin, Motrin, Aleve, Celebrex. They all work by slowing this line down, and they do help solve some of the symptoms of inflammation. The drugs Singulair and Acalate, which are mainly respiratory drugs, I believe, they slow down another set. So that would be another way of reducing inflammation because you'd have fewer E chemicals, and they're the ones that are actually causing the inflammation. Now, it turns out that fish oil and flaxseed oil, but flaxseed oil is not a really good alternative, but fish oil will slow down the same line here that these drugs do. And borage oil, you may or may not have heard of that. Evening primrose oil is another one, but again, borage oil has the most. It will slow down the production line here. And so then you'll have less inflammation because you're not putting out so many of these E chemicals. Okay, next. Okay, now I'm going to give you an example to show you what the situation is here. We have a sausage factory. This is the factory, and this is the machine in the factory. It gets some sort of stimulation, which is you plug it in, and that gets it going. Then you put some meat in, like you put in some pork, 100 pounds of pork, whatever, you put in some spices. The machine grinds it up, mixes it up, and then forms little pellets, and there you have your sausages. Now, in the case of chronic inflammation, you got too many sausages coming out because you're getting too much inflammation and your body isn't needed for good health. Okay, next. Okay, you look at a white cell. There's a very similar system. These C chemicals are the ones that stimulate this cell. And you have some meat in the inside, you have some enzymes, and out come the E chemicals. So there are a number of ways that you could reduce inflammation. And one would be to shut down the power. You'd think, well, just shut it off. You can't do that because you can't shut your white cell system completely down. Otherwise, how would you kill cancer cells that develop in your body? How would you kill germs? I mean, we can't live without our white cell system doing something. So you can't shut anything all the way down. But if you say put a transformer or whatever, get less power, you'd have less of these E chemicals coming out. Or if you were to take, say, a piece of wood or rag or metal or whatever and plug this opening up, then you wouldn't get the E chemicals either. Okay, so that would be another possibility. But there's another solution. If you don't want so many sausages, what else could you do? Is that clear? You put less meat in the machine. So instead of 100 pounds of pork meat, you put in 20 pounds. And it turns out the meat in these white cells is something called arachidonic acid. And that is an important word, I think. You'll hear more about it in the next 5 or 10 years, I think, than is known about it now. But it's clear in all the medical literature, all of these inflammatory chemicals come from arachidonic acid. So then you say, well, then that would be a way of shutting this part of the way down, slowing it down. So how do you give your body less arachidonic acid? It turns out, to my surprise, it's very easy to do. Next slide. Arachidonic acid is found in meat fat. It's found in liver, and it's found in eggs. So one way of reducing inflammation in your body, whatever the inflammation is don't get enough meat to work with. And if you look at these numbers, you don't know what's an ideal number. I would wild guess on my part, you only need 20 a day. You do have to have some arachidonic acid. You can't shut the system all the way down. But if you eat 2 eggs, you get 190. That's a pretty high number. If you eat chicken liver, a medium serving, that'd be about 3 ounces. Chicken liver, beef liver, pork liver, any kind of liver, the number's 520. So, I mean, you're really giving your body a lot of arachidonic acid to work with. If you look at chicken, white meat, which is considered by many people to be much better than red meat, for inflammation, it's not. Even white meat without the skin is 90, and the dark meat's about 130. You look at pork, lean pork is about 80, but if you have fatty pork, like pork sausage, even after you cook it, it's about 180. And if you have lean beef, it's 50. If you just have regular beef, of course, a lot of the fat cooks out of it, then it's about 60. And so it may surprise you that beef is so healthy from an inflammation point of view. And the reason is the fat in beef is highly saturated, which is not great for your cholesterol, possibly, but it's really great for inflammation. Now, we get to farm-raised salmon. That one is completely off the chart. And it's a very popular thing. A lot of people think they're eating very healthy when they eat salmon. And most of the salmon you find is farm-raised, although a lot of groceries, Publix, tells you whether it's farm-raised or wild salmon, because it's important to people who know about this. If you have farm-raised salmon, it's 1,200. Wild salmon runs around 100. So what is the difference? Well, the difference is farm-raised salmon are fed grains, and that's their main diet, is soybeans, corn, cornmeal, soy milk, whatever. They're fed grains. When salmon eat a diet of grains, they make more arachidonic acid in their fat. If they're in the wild, they eat algae. It's a completely different diet, and they have much less of this inflammatory fat in them. But tuna catfish are about 80, crab meat snapper about 80. Other fish and shellfish run between 5 and 20, and I would say more of them run to the 5 than to the 20. So from an inflammation point of view, fish is good. And then you get to vegetables, fruits, and grains. They have no arachidonic acid. And milk and milk products have so little that it rounds off to the number 0. Now, you think, well, I'm a vegetarian, so I'm home free here. Okay, first of all, I said you have to have some arachidonic acid. And your body can take some of the vegetable oils, you know, like soybean oil, whatever oil, and it can convert a small amount of that to arachidonic acid. So even if you're a vegetarian, you're going to get a little bit of arachidonic acid, which is all you need. Okay. Next. Okay, got another story. I got 2 stories to tell you now. They're not true. Once upon a time, I was taking a shower. I got out of the shower. I sat down on a bench in the bathroom. Unknown to me, there was a tack in the bench. So I sat down. I felt a sudden onset of severe pain in my right buttock. I said, whoa, this is something serious. I better call the doctor. So I called the doctor. Well, like, we can't see you till Friday. Okay. Friday I come, I see the doctor, and I say, I've had The minute I stepped out of the shower, I had this horrible pain in my right buttock. And I'd been taking aspirin, Tylenol, not doing any good at all. And he said, well, I could write you a prescription from some narcotic pain medicine. It'll take care of the pain. So he said, now take it the way I say it because it's strong stuff. So he writes me a prescription for the narcotic. He said, anything else? Well, yeah. I said, I've noticed ever since that happened, I've had bleeding, and I've had so much blood on my underpants, I had to change them 3 or 4 times a day. And then when I go to bed, I'm bleeding so much, I'm getting everything. I have to sleep on 2 towels now. I said, I've lost a lot of blood since that happened. He said, oh, go across the hall, get a blood test. We'll see. Maybe you're anemic. He said, tell him to run at STAT, bring me the results back. He said, oh, yeah, looks like you are developing some anemia. He said, I'll give you a B12 shot. I can give you some iron, a prescription for iron pills. And, you know, come back in a week. If it's not any better, maybe we'll give you a blood transfusion. Okay, that's story number one. Story number two. Once upon a time, I was taking a shower. I stepped out of the shower, sat down on the same bench with the tack. I felt a sudden onset of severe pain in my right buttock and down my leg. So I stood up, I felt in the back, I felt the tack, and I pulled it out. Okay, what's the moral of the story? Should be pretty obvious. If you know the cause, then it's a much better thing than just treating the symptoms. And yet, you look at all these chronic inflammatory problems, the vast majority of them, you get treated for the symptoms. Now, I can't blame the first doctor because, I mean, he didn't know I had a tack in my butt. That's all he had to go on. So he's trying to treat the symptoms. And a lot of inflammatory problems, it is not generally known what the basic cause is. Now, if it's an allergy, you know, you can find out the cause of that. If you have pneumonia, you know, they know the cause of that, then you can treat the cause. And a problem with inflammation is there are often more than one cause. So say you have 5 things in your body that are screwed up or causing inflammation. You say, well, I'm going to check this. Maybe it's whatever. And you try that, you see nothing. And you say, well, that couldn't be it. Well, it could be it. Because you had the other 4 things that were still operating. So see, it's a more complicated process. I would say, though, that there are a group of physicians now who are very concerned about this. And they have something called Institute of Functional Medicine. And they work with the patient to find out what is the cause. Now, back 6-5 years ago, when I was trying to find out, I had gotten this arachidonic acid, helped me quite a bit. But it still wasn't, you know, that's not ideal because whatever is causing the problem was still there. I just wasn't giving my body enough to overreact. So the key is, how do you find the cause? So I spent about 3 years, all my spare time, I'm reading, trying to find out these things. And I came up with a set of causes of inflammation. Now, once you know the causes, then you have to find out which ones apply to you if you have a problem. And I would say in the past couple of years, I've got well. You see, I'm now. I don't have that rash now. You can see a little spot here and there, but that's it. So it turns out that 3 months ago, I saw a review of a book called... And this is in your notes, so you don't have to write down the Immune System Recovery Plan. And this physician, Dr. Blum, did essentially the same thing that I did on my own. So if she had written it 6 years ago, it would have saved me a lot of study. But I found most of the things that I discovered were causes of inflammation are in this book. Now, some of them I found that are not in the book, and she found a lot of information that I didn't have. But it's a very good book. Okay, so then what are the causes of inflammation? That's really the bottom line. Okay, first one is certain foods and things that you're allergic to. Okay, we'll deal with the allergies first because they're much simpler than, and most people know about allergies. An allergy would be when the body has an inflammatory reaction to something that would be harmless to other people, like peanuts. You have a peanut allergy, you have an allergy to pollen, you have an allergy to shrimp, whatever. The one thing about allergen, you pretty well know it. Like if you eat some shrimp and you're allergic to shrimp, you'll see in a few hours some kind of a reaction. The reaction usually is not dependent on the extent of exposure. So a person who has eaten a peanut and developed these peanut antibodies, they can eat one peanut or they can eat a cup of peanut butter. They're going to get a full reaction either way. And then usually you do have antibodies involved in allergies. Okay, next. For me, a much more important thing was food intolerances. And so this is something I want to make sure you understand really well. They are caused by proteins in some foods. And these proteins are called lectins. If you have, you know, if you are interested in this topic, you could Google lectin. You could look on Wikipedia, whatever. And the proteins in these foods are able to attach to the walls of your intestines. And the reaction usually takes 2 or 3 days to develop. So, for instance, if it's a food that you have an intolerance to, you eat it on Monday, you don't have a rash till Thursday, you're not going to remember what you ate 3 days ago. So it's a lot harder to figure out what these things are. The reaction usually depends on the amount of exposure. You eat twice as much of the food you're intolerant to, you'll have a bigger reaction. So that's a little different than an allergy. And then usually, but not always, antibodies are not involved. Okay, next. Okay, I want to explain now about these food intolerances because it's very important they understand how they work. You have, this is a picture of the inner surface of your intestine. It's not smooth. It has a lot of little finger projections all over the place. They're called villi. And I've made a little sketch. I was actually trying to find a Google image, but they all have a lot of complications on them, so I just drew my own. Here is one of the villi right here. It has a layer of skin cells on the outside because, you know, the inside of your gut is the outside of your body, just like the inside of a donut is the outside. And so it has epithelial cells here. Then under these cells, you have a lot of white cells. You remember I told you 70% of your white cells are in your gut. They stay where there's most activity. Then you have blood vessels. You also have lymph vessel. Okay, next. Now, I put this picture here, but I think in your handout, I drew a better picture than is here. But you can look at this one for now. A lectin is a protein in some foods. And I would say, as an aside, why would a food have a lectin? And it turns out it's important for plants to have lectin foods. For instance, people and animals, if something tries to eat them, they can run away or fight, you know, the old flight or fight. A plant can't do that. So how is a plant going to stay around to reproduce and keep itself going? Well, they have evolved having proteins in them that will bind to any parasites or bacteria or viruses that the plant gets. And so they have these binding proteins on them. And actually, it turned out to be handy, although people have not eaten grains, for instance, for a long time. Wild animals have been around for a long, long time, and they needed some way to keep animals from eating them. So if you had a lectin protein, and that protein could do a little bit of damage to an animal, chances are they wouldn't eat that one again. So it's a protective mechanism for the plant. They weren't thinking about us when they made these. Okay. A lectin is a protein, so the major part of the protein would be here. But in this diagram, they have sort of an ending on somewhere in the protein. And this is sort of, you'd think of it as a binding foot. And here you have somebody who has a certain pattern of electrical charges on their skin cells. And in this case, the lectin foot exactly matches the charges on the skin. So then you have a chemical bond here. Now, if you have, if say these are the charges on your skin, and here are the charges on that same protein, you notice they don't match, so you won't have binding. And so that's how lectin works. It works by binding onto the cells that line the villi. Okay, next. Now, here is a diagram of three healthy cells in the gut, the skin cells. And you notice they have a tight binding between them, and they're all nice and healthy. Things are going just fine. But some lectins come along. Now, I would also say your body does not accept protein from any other source. Now, you say, what do you mean by that? The proteins in our body are people proteins. They're not dog proteins. They're not rat proteins. They're people proteins. We have no use for a cow protein. So what your body does is it breaks down the protein into the individual amino acids, which there could be 5,000, could be 50,000. And you have a long chain of amino acids sort of wadded up. And that is what it's not actually wadded. It's a very special structure, but you get the idea. So in digestion, it's very important that we break the proteins down to their amino acids. Then these cells can shunt the amino acids through them, and they get into the circulation, then they go into your body. So that's the way proteins are digested. Now, it turns out most lectin proteins are harder to digest than regular proteins. But even so, even if it weren't that much harder, if you eat a lot of a food that has a certain lectin in it that happens to match your cells, you're going to get binding. And what happens then, you develop something called a leaky gut. And so not only do you have spaces between these skin cells, but the cells themselves get damaged. Now, here are all these white cells underneath just waiting for a problem to get stimulated by. And the minute these proteins start getting, you just have this leak here in the gut. Now, regular proteins can get in. Now, remember, protein is a molecule. This is a cell. So we're talking a different order of magnitude. But your body is not supposed to let proteins in. And now it did let some proteins in because you got a leak here caused by the inflammation, the damage of the lectin proteins. And so the minute these proteins get in, your white cells get stimulated to act because that's a foreign material. And so they go to town, and next thing you know, you have inflammation. Now, if that weren't bad enough, an even worse thing is these lectin proteins, say it's beans has a protein that you have a problem with. Not only will it let other proteins through, but some of the lectin proteins will get through too. So now you're really in trouble because it's not just a question of proteins are getting through, but it's the ones with the binding feet that are getting through. And what do? They circulate around, and if they find something else to bind to, they bind. And if it's a certain type of protein and you have a certain type of cell, they'll bind to your thyroid, or they might bind to your joints, or they may bind to something else. But notice, the white cells, it's not their fault. The white cells see something wrong and they try to fix it. But it's the lectin protein. Many scientists now feel that this is the basis of autoimmunity. The white cells are attacking, supposedly, the tissue, but they're only attacking it because it got damaged by something. And so that's a problem here. Okay, next slide. Okay, now we say, well, okay, I understand what you're saying, but how do I know which are, you know, is there a blood test that can tell me which lectin proteins I might have a food intolerance to? It turns out gluten is a set of two lectin proteins, and there is a test for gluten. So you can go to a doctor and ask to be tested for gluten. It's a but as far as I know, there are no other foods that you can check, that you can have a blood test for. So the only thing you can do, if you want to really know what is it that's causing my inflammation, is you can cut out a lot of foods. In fact, you could just not eat anything for a couple of days, and then eat something like you could eat rice and carrots and celery. Now, those are three foods that are very seldom involved in these food intolerances. So, but you don't have to be that severe. You have to do it for several days, like 7 to 10 days, for it to all get out of your system. And then if you start getting better, whatever better means, then you start adding one food back every 2 or 3 days and see if you get worse again. So you cut everything out and you say, well, I'm going to check out beans. So then the next day, you know, after you've sort of cleaned yourself out, you eat a couple of large servings of beans. And if the symptoms come back, you know it's beans. And if they don't come back, then you say, well, probably beans are not a culprit here. So, the question is, what do you mean by get better? What are symptoms of chronic inflammation? Well, if you have arthritis, you know what it is. You know, some of the ones that have a name to them, you would know what the symptoms are. But a lot of people have just tiredness. They, like fibromyalgia patients, you know, they just feel really tired all the time. Or people have what's called brain fog. You know, they just feel like their brain isn't working very well. And, you know, that's a problem when you start getting older because you don't know if it's just part of aging. A lot of people with inflammation, just sort of a lower level of inflammation, will wake up with a headache. And so if you have headaches, that would be a possibility. This dry mouth and dry eyes would be symptoms of, or any kind of a breakout in your skin would obviously be a problem. Okay, the most likely foods they found that cause food intolerances are, first one, I put whole wheat. Now, I'm not talking about wheat now, like white flour. I'm talking about whole wheat, which is supposed to be so healthy for you. And if you don't have any inflammation, it probably is healthy for you. But whole wheat has something called wheat gluten something. And it is a very powerful lectin. And so that is commonly a problem with people, especially they think they're doing good and start eating all whole wheat bread, and what they find is their symptoms get worse. Then the next one would be any grain with gluten. And that would be like white flour. Rye and barley also have gluten. And so that would be another possibility. Incidentally, I don't know if any of you all are watching PBS this week, but they have, it's one of their fundraising things. There is a physician now who has a program called Wheat Belly and Fit for Life or something. And what he's talking about is this gluten problem. And although he doesn't talk about lectins, you know, he doesn't talk about the mechanism. But that's what he's saying. This is a lot of people with inflammatory problems. They just quit eating wheat. And even grains, all grains would be even better. They will get better. Okay, and then starchy beans is another big family. This would be like navy beans, kidney beans, lima beans, red beans. And it includes soybeans, which is supposed to be a health food, and peanuts. Because peanuts are a bean. They're a member of the legume family. So these would be the ones that you would want to make sure that you don't eat for a while. And then there are other problem foods that come up often enough. And these would be the nightshade plants. They're tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, and eggplant. And they can all cause food intolerance. Milk and dairy products, and this is not lactose intolerance. This is intolerance to the dairy itself. And then corn is another grain that can cause food intolerances. So if you really wanted to find it, it's a hard thing to do. And I had to try three or four times before I had the willpower to stick with it. But once you find out, you know for the rest of your life. And if you have a serious inflammatory problem, it's worth your time. Okay, next. Okay, now that's food intolerances. That's one cause of inflammation. I would say it's probably, in my case, was the biggest cause. But there's another one that is a big one, and that's not enough good bacteria in your gut. And you say, well, you know, I know good bacteria are good, but what's it got to do with inflammation? Well, first of all, good bacteria help to digest your food, and they help to break down some of the toxins. And, you know, if toxins get in your body, that causes inflammation. They sit on the lining of your small intestine, and they help protect the cells, and they strengthen the cells there. As a matter of fact, these little bacteria actually make some kind of a fatty acid that gets in the cells and makes the cells stronger. Then they help process vitamin B12 and vitamin K so they can be used by the body, because a lot of vitamins have to be changed over to a different form before the body can use them. And then they help turn off inflammation by aiding the white cells that put on the brake. In other words, the ones that slow things down. And it's called IgA, if you ever read anything about it. Okay, next. Okay, so what can you do to support your gut and improve the amount of good bacteria? Well, one, you could take a probiotic supplement. Or you could eat, like some yogurts have probiotics in them. It contains good bacteria that will crowd out the bad ones. Then there, and this I got from the book, I've never tried it myself. There's coconut oil, oregano oil, thyme oil, and grapefruit seed extract are all supplements that you can get from any health food store. They help to kill some of the bad bacteria and the yeasts in your gut. Then there are foods like high fiber foods, onions, blueberries, and bananas. They are especially good for feeding the good bacteria. And so the idea is you've got to have a lot of good bacteria in your gut to help out. And then L-glutamine and zinc supplements help strengthen the gut wall as well. So these are some things that have been recommended by this physician for people who want to increase the support the good bacteria in your gut. You know, the reason bad bacteria are called bad is they eat your food just like the good bacteria do. But they, when they excrete their waste products, they're toxic to us. And so that's why you don't want a bad bacteria. And if you take an antibiotic, it's very important to take a probiotic afterwards to get the good bacteria back in your gut and working. Okay, next. Here's a third cause, exposure to toxins that overwork your liver. Well, there's a lot of publicity about all the toxins in our environments, in the air we breathe, in the water we drink, in the foods, you know, toxins are all over the place. And frankly, living in our society, you cannot cut the toxic, some of the toxins that you're exposed to 100%. There's just no way to do it. And although I'm not going to go into all the toxic things, mercury is one that promotes autoimmunity in the thyroid gland. It can also get into the brain and cause tremors, depression, memory loss, and fatigue. So those are some problems of the toxins. Estrogen-like compounds given to cattle and chickens promote inflammatory disorders, especially lupus is one. And then they're now finding, if you check municipal water supplies, they all have small traces of drugs. You know, people take a lot of pills, they go to the bathroom, it gets in the water supply, and they clean up most of it, but there's still some drugs in the water supply that we have. Okay, next. So the question is, how can you remove toxins from your body? Well, there are people who go into this thing called detox, and I'm not even going to talk about that. If you did it, if you wanted to, you should go to a physician and be under a physician's care for that. But there are some things that you can do to help your body remove toxins from your body. One is our bodies make something called glutathione, which is an antioxidant. And it is the main oxidant or main chemical that can detoxify heavy metals. So you could take, glutathione. Is it? The interesting thing is our bodies make the glutathione. But what happens is it gets used up, especially if you have a high toxic load. You can take a supplement called alpha-lipoic acid, which is something the body normally makes in very small amounts. So it's not, it's something that's natural in smaller amounts. It's also an antioxidant. And it's been found that it will help to recharge the glutathione so it can detoxify more of the heavy metals in your body. Then soluble fiber and high-fiber foods help to pull toxin and estrogen compounds out of the body. And the B vitamins, zinc, selenium, magnesium, copper, manganese also help the liver to detoxify bad substances. But my feeling is you have to be careful about this because a lot of these minerals have a balance in your body, like zinc and copper. You give your body a lot of copper, the zinc goes down. You give your body a lot of zinc, copper. So your body's trying to keep everything smooth. So if you were going to take some of these supplements, it would be better to take a little of several than to take a whole lot of one, in my opinion. Okay, next. Okay, here's another cause of inflammation, chronic stress. And anyone who has a problem with an inflammatory problem knows that if you're under a lot of stress, you're going to get worse. And for instance, my rash, I could tell if I was under stress, I would break out a little more. Not under stress, it go away. Now, what happens is, it's a complicated thing, as all everything I'm telling you is, but our adrenal glands produce adrenaline, but they also produce cortisol, and that is the main anti-inflammatory hormone in the body, cortisol. It's produced in stressful situations to keep inflammation from getting out of hand. Now, here's a problem. If you have stress, day after day, week after week, month after month, you have financial problems, you have illness in the family, you know, you have a lot of problems that you don't seem to be able to solve. And the adrenal glands become fatigued, and they are not able to produce enough cortisol. And you think of people like they have a bad knee, they go to the doctor, they get a shot of cortisol, right? Because their adrenal glands have just not, they can't produce cortisol anymore. They've sort of used up what their adrenal glands can do. And so that's part of this. Also, under stress, there are, first of all, there are nerve impulses when you're under stress. They go to different parts of the body. And one thing they do is they go to, like, your bone marrow, and they promote more white cell formation, which means that you can have a potential for a lot more inflammation. But the compound IgA, which is the thing that was helping in the gut, it's needed to support the good bacteria in the gut. But if you're under chronic stress, you lose the ability to make this material in this compound. So then you're worse off. So the immune system gradually gets worn down and grows old before it's time. Probably all of us know that as you get older, your immune system isn't quite up, it doesn't work quite as efficiently. But if you're under stress all the time, it's going to get old a lot faster. Okay, next. Okay, these are other sources of inflammation. I'm about out of time, so I'm not going to say a lot about them. Not enough antioxidants in the body. And in normal cell activity, free radicals are formed. They're just part of the system. And we have these antioxidants, like the glutathione, that clean up these free radicals. And if you have antioxidants, that's what they do. So if you eat foods that have a lot of antioxidants in them, like the dark green vegetables, the dark red fruits and so forth, the ones that have a lot of color to them, then you'll get more antioxidants. And sometimes that's enough to help you, because if you don't have these cells dying from free radical damage, that's less work your body has to do, so less inflammation. And this should be pretty obvious. If you have a respiratory or any other kind of infection, then your inflammation level is going to go up. And you say, well, yeah, but, you know, cold, you get over that shortly. That's true. Some people, though, have a bladder infection for a long time. And some people have dental infection of their gums. They go for years without getting it treated. And this is going to cause damage to your, it's going to cause stimulation of your immune system. Being overweight is sort of interesting because I told you white blood cells are in all the tissues of the body. And if you're carrying a lot of extra weight, there are white cells in that fatty tissue. And they're sort of under stress when they're in the fatty tissue, and they put out stress signals. And so a lot of people find if they can lose 20, 30, 40 pounds, they can get better from whatever the inflammatory problem is. And especially like people with arthritis, you know, the doctor says, well, you ought to lose some weight because you're putting so much pressure on the joint. And that's true. But the weight is also producing inflammation on its own. So you get a double whammy there. And then elevated blood sugar. And again, I don't have time to talk about it, but if you have a high glucose level, that will cause your pancreas to secrete more insulin. And unfortunately, a side effect of insulin is that it promotes the inflammation process. And so those are some other things. So what you had to do, what I had to do, just go through all these things, check them out, and see which ones I thought applied to me. And if I got better, I say, well, that's it. So next slide. I think sort of in summary, I would say in these studies, that all this studying I did, I found my inflammation could be greatly reduced by lowering my intake of arachidonic acid. Worked better than any drugs, had no side effect, and did not cost $20,000 a year, or even, you know, $3 or $4 a pill. You know, it adds up. But the major cause, now, the arachidonic acid doesn't treat the cause. It only keeps your body from overreacting to what the cause is. But the major cause of my inflammation was an intolerance to a number of foods, these food intolerances. And then with these two steps, plus I take fish oil and borage oil every day, I take a probiotic every day, and I try to eat a lot of salads and fresh fruits and so forth, I was able to reduce my skin rash by about 98%, and I'm working on the last 2% right now. So I want to make this important point. Everything I've told you is in the scientific literature. This is not some weirdo thing like apricot pits in Mexico or whatever. This is all information in the scientific literature done by professors in medical schools. So I feel very comfortable about saying that what I'm telling you is important to know. And as I said, there are some doctors now, and a lot of doctors will admit it. They say, when I went to medical school, I didn't take nutrition. You know, it wasn't something. And so it's just now getting to where doctors are starting to be knowledgeable and concerned about this. And I'm sure if doctors knew a way to solve a problem without giving you all these expensive drugs, they would, you know, they would do it if they knew what to do. There is a group of physicians, as I said, who belong to an organization for functional medicine, and they deal with the causes of inflammation, among other things. I got on their website, and I printed out all the physicians in the Sarasota area within 50 miles that are a member of this organization. And as you go out, I only have 20 sheets, so if you don't want it, don't take it. And you can also look up Google functional medicine, and you can get the information on your own. But there is a sheet that has a list of all the physicians in our local area who know about this and are using this information to treat patients. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
If you have to leave, we understand, that's fine. But we'll take these in the order that you raise your hand. And if you have some back here is the first one. And I'd like the second over there.
Hi.
Hi.
I had the same skin rash, only worse than yours, but you said 40%, that started me on my journey. So I want to say I'm thankful for the list of doctors there, because I'm going to need that. But I'm going to say that when I started studying, I realized that it was a continuum, because I had psoriasis as a child, then I got a thyroid problem, then I got a mass on my breast after I got married from the stress, and then 8 years ago, I got that skin rash, which was, and my doctor said, you need to go to an allergist. Well, I didn't want to go to an allergist because they put poison underneath your skin, and I already had psoriasis, and I didn't want more bad stuff. But I will say, everything you said in here was way over the top valid. And I'm going to say what I use is the blueberries and the raspberries. I use the coconut oil. I use the omega-3. I use turmeric, zinc, and magnesium. And they have a great celiac support group here. I had to train my doctor, and even still now, he doesn't have a clue. I have to keep bringing articles to him. I have to train chefs about keeping my food separate for celiacs. But anyhow, my question is, how do you feel about the honey being a substitute for sugar so that you don't have your high blood sugar?
Okay, first of all, I use Splenda. And I know a lot of people don't like the artificial sweeteners. I know there's a problem with some of the others, like Equal can turn into wood alcohol, small amounts, but I've never personally seen any evidence about using Splenda that I don't... Well, I mean, I don't see a need for it, but if you like honey, it has a lot of good ingredients in it. I wouldn't say plus or minus as far as I'm concerned. I don't know of any articles that I read that said honey reduced inflammation. You know, it might be good for you, but I didn't read any.
How about GMOs? Did you have any research on GMOs?
GMO? Yeah, I don't know if you... I had an article in the paper, letter to the editor last Sunday about GMOs. Yeah, because they're saying, well, if you genetically modify plants... You know, you're just going to get plants that have more protein. You're going to feed more people. And I said, well, I don't. And this person who had written for the paper said, I've never seen any actual rationale for not using GMOs. But it turns out, say in the case of wheat was changed so it had twice as much protein in it. And they said, this is part of the Green Revolution. Now we can feed millions more people. But what they were doing is they were increasing the gluten in the wheat. So you take the wheat that we have now has twice as much gluten as the wheat that was used in 1940. And so it's a bigger problem now. And it's because of genetically modifying the plant. So in this one case, I don't know about other organisms, you know, what would happen if you modified tomatoes or with, but I do know in the case of wheat, it turned out not to be a blessing at all.